Nice. Don't you have like a opening kind of Old West reference to a podcast?
Yeehaw.
Yeehaw.
Yeehaw. Ride 'em, cowboy!
Hello, you are listening to Off Radar, It's a Movie Podcast. I'm James Smith, a professional film and video editor.
I'm James Etock, a freelance writer and illustrator specialising in 1980s cartoons.
And I'm Neil Brock, aka Nige, the man with two names, former film journalist and currently working in the games industry.
Each week, one of us picks a movie that all three of us either haven't seen in many years, or in some cases, haven't seen at all.
We each watch the chosen movie, return to the microphone, and let you all know exactly what we thought of it.
He desperately needs her to survive.
It's sort of handled some incredibly like delicate topics incredibly well.
I will never watch this again. What was that?
If you fancy joining in and suggesting a movie for us to watch, why not tweet us at OffRadarPodcast
or email us on offradarpod@gmail.com.
If you like what you hear, please subscribe, share, and by all means, leave a review.
For now, strap in, turn the volume up, and let's go
Off Radar.
I'm James Smith.
Let me just go and change my shirt.
All right. Hello, and welcome back to Off Radar. It's a movie podcast. I thought I'd add that bit in.
What?
My name is James Smith, and I am joined by Neil Brock.
Hello.
Who we call Nige. And James Etock.
Howdy.
Who we call
very good. Very
Etock.
Good.
Etock, man. That's...
That was on the spot. That was on the spot. That
I should have gone, hey, how are you? Oh, never mind.
No, or...
Yeah.
Howdy, cowpoke. No,
howdy.
Poking any cows.
Well, we've lost all momentum now. Let's go.
Yeah, let's get there.
let's over.
Stop. Today we are talking about a film called Once Upon a Time in the West, which was made in or came out in 1968.
The oldest movie this podcast has covered thus far, correct?
Yeah. That is, yeah.
And the original title is Sarà una volta il West, which is the worst Italian accent you will ever hear in your life, because it wasn't even attempted.
Was that Italian? Oh, okay.
Rude.
I thought that was like, it sounded like Borat.
That would be a different version. Yeah, so the film, just very quickly, it was directed and written by Sergio Leone. Most people know what he's done, but he did quite a number of Westerns before this. So he did A Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. And then quite a few years later, he did Once Upon a Time in America, which is also one of his most popular films. It stars Henry Fonda, Charles Bronson, Jason Robards and Claudia Cardinale.
She actually gets top billing as well when the credits sort of roll at the start. She is the top billing, which was really against sort of Sergio Leone's sort of makeup of the films he made, where it was predominantly male actors.
Well, especially at that time, right, in the 60s. Like,
he'd kind of been accused of misogyny as well, in the sense of the way he portrayed women in film. So it was a really kind of bold step for her to be listed as... Because she's a huge Italian actress, but in this film, much like a lot of his films, the English was actually dubbed by someone else. So,
Had we seen this film before we went away and watched it for the podcast?
So I actually owned it on DVD. It's one of the few DVDs I've still got,
right?
Because I just thought, well, this is a film I want to keep in my collection. And I can't remember why. I think I've got a vague recollection that it was just listed as a film you must see in like Empire magazine or Total Film back in sort of maybe like the mid to late 90s. So yeah, I had a chance to check it out then.
Etock, did you seen this one?
No, I hadn't seen it. Well, it's always such a weird question.
Yeah, I know. I've seen it now.
Yeah. So I was flicking through Sky Movies and something just caught my eye and I was like, huh. And it was the opening to this movie and I didn't recognise it because I'd heard of this movie. I was aware of Sergio Leone's work, but I had never seen it. But one of the actors in the first opening scene, one of the three assassins, I thought to myself, this is no word. I was like, I swear that's the mad doctor from the Cannonball Run movies. If you've ever seen the Cannonball Run movies, Burt Reynolds and Dom DeLuise have this doctor on board because in the first movie they drive an ambulance and use that as like a way to get from sea to shining sea, as it were. So the doctor is this kind of almost, I guess, Dr. Jekyll-esque kind of character in the Cannonball Run movies. And sure enough, it was the same actor. But as a testament to filmmaking, I turned the channel. I was like, I'm sure that's the guy. And then I found myself nearly 3 hours later still watching the movie going, oh, wow, I'm still watching this movie, which is kind of...
And Etok then suggested it for the podcast. For me, it's one of those films that's kind of been on the list, but I've never seen. I've seen, like, his other work, like... most of what I read off, you know, the other westerns, and once
the Man with No Name series, yeah
exactly. But this was one that I had just like kind of passed me by, and it is like always on a list, like that someone says you must see this film. And it's just you know, like I think westerns in general, you know, I've kind of watched over the years and liked, but I think for a while westerns became so big that I was kind of done with them for a while. I needed a break from them, and so did a lot of audience members, hence why they kind of stopped making them for a long time, and then kind of gangster films kind of took that instead. But anyway, so I had not seen this film, and I have now watched it. I think the western, before we go into the film, the western genre is a good one. Are you guys fans of the genre in general?
I would say probably not at all.
Yeah.
I've tried to watch the odd John Wayne movie in the past, and this is no disrespect. I'm sure there are some really good John Wayne movies, but I just find them just not really grabbing my attention. I find them quite flat at times. And like I said, I'm sure there are classics, so I don't want to just go flat out, oh, no, not at all. But I've never seen, and Nige may go, what? You may also say, well, I've never seen Young Guns or Young Guns 2.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Or what's the one with Val Kilmer? I'll be your Tombstone. Huckleberry. Tombstone. Yeah. I've not seen after one, we actually. Did, I want to see the Sam Raimi one.
Quick and the Dead, yeah.
Still haven't seen that, but I remember like someone...
You've seen Unforgiven with Gene Hackman and Morgan Freeman?
I've actually seen half of that movie, and I really enjoyed it. But so I need to obviously go back and watch it. But yeah, in short, Smith, I wouldn't say I'm a fan of westerns in the slightest. I'd seen Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and really enjoyed it, but not enough to say, let's do it on the podcast. So
I just found it quite amusing that, like, talking about do you like westerns, and the first western you referenced was Young Guns.
Yeah.
Which is like, I think there's going to be some purists who are a bit like, really?
Really?
Yeah. Like, personally, I quite like the western genre. I know, again, this kind of goes back to my, like, sort of love of film, I think, when I was sort of growing up and just wanting to explore lots of different genres. And I know that during like the 30s, 40s, 50s, there was this big sort of movement of Western films in America. They were really cheap to make. They could sort of churn them out. They often sort of followed the same kind of story. And then sort of within the 60s, as Smith said with Leone, they kind of had the spaghetti westerns, which were kind of told from a slightly different perspective. Like, very rarely was it about cowboys and Indians. Very rarely was it this kind of generic story. They quite often sort of took on some of those sort of classic examples of what would happen and sort of twisted it a little bit. And I think this film especially has so much influence from kind of like the John Ford, John Wayne films. And
yes, definitely.
I mean, there's loads of like specific scenes that are almost shot for shot, or specific examples of where things happen in this film that are taken directly from other sort of well-known American films. But to kind of go back to the original point, yeah, like westerns, I do enjoy. I kind of like the style of them. I like the sort of bleakness quite often of the old West, and the fact that people are always looking for this kind of fresh start. And quite often there's obviously outlaws, there's violence, and there's been some great sort of TV shows like Deadwood, for instance, that have kind of in more modern times taken on that kind of Western genre, and even to a lesser extent, Westworld, both the kind of sci-fi film back in the sort of 70s and the TV show, which is certainly the first series, was incredibly enjoyable.
It's interesting. You mentioned John Ford there. So in film studies, we studied Stagecoach, which was one of his early ones with John Wayne. And when I watched this film, I I was like, wow, some of the shots and some of the influences that, you know, Sergio Leone has taken from John Ford and from that film, which was one of the film one, you know, we kind of studied. So it's really interesting watching this with kind of that hat on. As far as being a fan, I would say that, yeah, I wouldn't say I've never ever loved Westerns. Like, I've always found, like, some of the ones that I've seen very formulaic and very, you know, it's kind of like the goodie and the baddie. They face off and, you know, have a gun shootout at the end. And I think that was always the thing. The ones that I'd seen were always, you kind of knew what you were going to happen as soon as it began. So it's interesting coming into a film like this where, you know, it's kind of makes you think it's going to be like that, but actually it kind of flips the script a little bit, which leads me nicely onto Etop. Would you mind giving us a little kind of brief rundown of the kind of story?
Brief. I'll do my best. The thing I found with it is there are so many lead characters in it. It's not one person's film.
Oh, there's four, aren't there? Four distinct.
So, yeah, you've got Jill, you've got Frank, you've got Harmonica, Cheyenne. They're your main four.
Then they've all got a soundtrack as well, haven't they? Which we'll
come on to. Oh, the soundtrack. I mean, I know we're jumping ahead, but, like, oh, my, you, Nigel, this is kind of your bag, isn't it? The Ennio Morricone?
Yeah, Morricone, who's kind of known as, like, the quintessential sort of
Did he do The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly as well?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's where I knew the name from. I love Cheyenne's theme. I love the fact Harmonica's theme is, obviously, the harmonica. Jill's got her own theme. Going back to the synopses. So, yeah, I wrote the kind of synopses in terms of the characters and how they're connected. So, first we have Jill. She journeys to the town of Flagstone to marry Brett McBain, but he McBain. And his family of three. But he McBain. And his family of three. You're not going to let me do it, are
Sorry.
You? But he and his family of three children are murdered shortly before she arrives, and they are murdered by Frank, played by good old Henry Fonda. He was paid to intimidate Jill's husband-to-be. By Morton, who's a railroad tycoon desiring to own a piece of, I guess, soon to be very valuable land. But Frank also has a history with Harmonica, played by legend Charles Bronson. I won't spoil then why Harmonica's after Frank, but ooh, there's something bad happened, and Charles Bronson wants vengeance. And then we have Cheyenne, who might be my favorite character in the movie. He's kind of an outlaw or a bandit, I guess, but he's wanted for the murder of the McBain family because he's been framed, and he's kind of been almost like framed for the first attempt on Harmonica's life at the beginning of the movie. There are these three guys that I mentioned in the opening scene, which is incredible. In short, the story is primarily about Harmonica and kind of Cheyenne reluctantly teaming up, I guess, is the best Marvel way to put it. to kill Frank. And kind of thus look after the interests of Jill McBain. But you have to stress, and one of the things I love about this movie, none of these people are good people. They're all flawed in some way, or even, you know, they've all got their own kind of moral code or compass, whether that be a lady of the night or a killer or a guy out for revenge or a bandit or whatever. They've all got their own kind of ideas of, you know, right from wrong. There's no sentimentality in this film. Maureen!
Jill as well, like, quite often, as I said, in this era, like, women were seen as relatively weak characters in these types of films, like damsels in distress. She is not that. She is, there's one, like, brutal scene where she's talking about them potentially, like, these bandits essentially raping her, and he's like, it's fine, I'll just, like, have a wash afterwards and I'll get on with my life. And, like, that is, she's that cold in the sense of, like, I've been through all this shit throughout my life. For, like, I've been a prostitute in New Orleans, I've now come to what was supposed to be, like, my escape from that life with this man I love and the children and potential for money, and it's all been taken away from me. So what more can you take away from me?
So you think I'll say yes and go live in the country. I wouldn't mind giving him half a dozen kids after all. Take care of a house. Do something, what the hell.
They come kind of at points dangerously close to what you would, I guess, in a modern film or in a modern society perceive as like utter, you know, you can't treat women this way. You can't treat women this way on film. But it's like, well, one, this is set in the old West where I think values for women were very different back then. But also what you say is that she can hold her own. I think that's what I really liked about her character. And there's something about the actress and just, you know, sometimes casting is such a powerful tool. Like her eyes are such a focal point. So many of these characters, their eyes, I know it sounds really, but their eyes are, she's got these big dark eyes and they're very emotive. And then you've got like Bronson and Robbins, you've got these like very, you know, very kind of weather beaten eyes. But then you've got obviously Henry Fonda with the, you know,
the dashing bright, blue eyes,
scarily blue eyes. And it's like ice when he cold. Smiles, it's just terrifying. It's like, wow, this guy is. Yeah, you buy into the fact that this guy is a real nasty piece of work.
Well, just with her there, there's this excellent scene which she kind of like sees the dead bodies, and it's almost underplayed in the fact that so often we're used to seeing kind of acting when someone's died or something, you know, being kind of over the top and screaming and shouting. But with her, it's almost like this seeping realization that, and it's really well acted and directed, you know, that you're basically coming to terms with this. And like you said, basically it's so well done in the eyes, that moment that you feel so much for that character and for the, you know, for what she's gone through, and you know that really makes you bloody well care about kind of what everybody's motives are in this film.
Rick McPain and I were married a month ago.
I think that was the thing that I found really interesting about this to begin with. Like, we don't know what Frank, Henry Fonda's character, is getting out of this. And we don't know for quite a long time in this film. So you're trying to figure that out. But you're also...
Just talk about his first appearance? Sorry, not to jump in. Yeah. Frank's first appearance, Henry Fonda, shoots a family. But the most brutal one is like, he's looking at this kid...
Yeah.
And you think, and then the other guy turns, one of his like cohorts turns to him and says, "What are we going to do, Frank?" And he's like, "Well, now you've said my name." And then just, you get that close up of the kid's face looking all kind of, I guess, confused, perplexed.
Well,
terrified.
He's got like his feet pointing together. He's holding like a bottle of like bourbon or whatever it is. And yeah, he looks terrified and like just not quite sure what's going on. And like,
and Frank.
Well, the thing with Henry Fonda as well, just to jump in on this, is that he was traditionally known as like basically like the modern day Tom Hanks, like America's sweetheart. He'd done all these films, like had been really well known for like, I think it was like The Grapes of Wrath and those kind of films where he plays like a dashing gentleman and his blue eyes. And when he first showed up for filming on the set, he'd like grown this big beard and had brown contacts in. And Sergio Leone said, "No, you've got to get rid of all that.
Wow.
What I want is the coldness of your eyes." And when it sort of the camera pans around to him and comes up and it's Henry Fonda, you see his face.
It's a great reveal.
And like that icy cold nature of him. It's really quite a staggering scene, I would say. And to be honest, the first three scenes of this film, so you've got the train station, you've got obviously this happens and then it goes back to the train station when she arrives, and they are three sort of unbelievably like three of potentially the best film scenes ever put together in a row in a film. They're good.
The interesting thing with that first scene, so I to watch this film, I bought it secondhand on DVD, put the DVD player in, started watching this film. So you've got like minimal music to begin with, no dialogue, just sound effects. You know, there's like wind, flies, creaking, knuckle cracking.
The dripping water onto
dripping.
His hat. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
And then... it's the sound is broken, like there is dialogue, but it's after, I don't know, maybe like 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and they started talking in German and I was like, oh shit.
I had the same thing when we must have the same DVD, because I had exactly the same thing.
I watched
when
the first
I was watching
3 minutes
it the other day.
In German, and I didn't realize.
I didn't do that. I realized straight
so
away.
So I had to change the audio dialogue, and then because of the way the DVD's author, which you probably did as well, I then watched it again. It's obviously exactly the same, and then I was like, oh, at least I can understand, because for a second I was like, shit, am I going to have to watch this whole film in German.
The thing was as well, like when I did it, when I changed it to English, I thought, this is really out of sync. What's going on? And then I realised it's because a lot of the actors in this film are Italian, speaking Italian, and they were dubbed. And to be honest, they weren't necessarily dubbed that well. Certainly in the first three guys, I think two of them are Italian. And the black guy, he was really well known for a lot of like John Ford's films as being like a perennial actor in them. And it was sort of quite iconic for him to be in it. And obviously in this first scene, you get Charles Bronson introduced at the train station, and these three characters who are all quite big names for kind of Western films in that time do not last beyond this scene. So it's
yeah, like that opening scene, what the thing, like I say, that was literally what drew me into this film, as any opening scene of any movie should do. But like I said, it was late, I was changing channels, and I just thought, it's the guy from the Cannonball Run movie.
It sucks you in.
But then I was just like, it was the shot as well that I was fascinated by, where the flies on his face. I'm watching that thinking, like, this shot, I knew it was a Leone movie, but I was like, this shot is so long, but why am I still watching it? And that's a real fly. This is, you know, obviously this isn't, you know, in the 60s, you could animate something, but I was like, that's a real fly. The only fake fly you see in that scene is when it's going up the chair, and it's clearly like a magnetized fly, and he puts the gun over it. But when it's on his face, I'm watching that thinking, like, that's a real... What, did they train a fly?
He's trying to blow it as well for ages.
It's hilarious. But it's amazing because it's comical. And he's got that, you know, that he was famous for having, like, the wonky eye, that the actor. Yeah. The guy from the Cannonball Run movies. And it's just... He's so funny in that scene. This opening scene, it's so annoying that it's taken me 44 years of my life to see it. That's how much I think it's incredible. I was like, why have I never fucking seen this scene before? I was just captivated. And like the sound, the noise of that fan that just keeps making the same, or like the, yeah, it's like a...
There's a story about that. When the sound designer got there, they kind of said, do you want me to, like, should we get some like WD-40 or something equivalent and get rid of the sound? And Sergio Leone is like, if you touch that, I will kill you. So it knew it was going to be so iconic as part of like that shot and that scene. And the bit with the fly as well, that kind of plays homage to, I don't know if it's like a Buster Keaton film where he has a gun and shoots a fly. Obviously it's quite similar, he catches the fly in the barrel of the gun and then covers it up, and you just hear it buzzing around.
At this point, but we should shout out the DOP, Tonino Delli Colli, because the I have not done his name any justice there, but there's
better than I could have done.
But the cinematography throughout this whole film is breathtaking. There's silhouettes, there's shots like that are ahead of its time. So there's a bit, a funeral scene where like dirt is thrown on the camera. That's like Breaking Bad style, you know, like that. It kind of reminded me of Breaking Bad, like some of the cinematography, because of, you know, and you know, I'm sure it's influenced by many films, but yeah, the DOP and you know, Leone working like this captivate this so well, and the West as well, you know, like the set design being transported into the 1800s. It's very different to some of the other Westerns that I've seen. It's very raw and grimy. And
that's a Smith, that's literally one of my things about this whole movie, is that it's weird. You watch this and at times, this sounds really weird, you forget that everything you're looking at is our costumes, set design, this, that, and the other, because it's so raw. Like, you feel what it must have been like to be in the old West. Like, water wasn't, you know, just a tap away.
It's so funny you say that, because it was largely shot in like the Spanish desert. Like, it wasn't, there's a couple of shots where they shot it in America.
There's definitely shots of Utah.
The John Ford, like the director at the very end, went out there and basically said, I need a couple of these shots because they're so... But most of it was shot in Rome on sound stages, and the rest was shot in the Spanish desert.
Some of the town shots, they're all extras. They're all hired people. And yet you feel like you're looking at Native American Indians getting off a train, or, you know, all these different... races, people coming together in America in the early and in the old West towns, and you know, obviously the railroads were obviously built by a lot of slaves and stuff like that, but it doesn't hide away from that fact. And it's I just found it fascinating that it really convinces you that what you're looking at is 100% fact. That's the thing. Like, and I think that's the beauty of the filmmaking in this, the close-ups. There's nothing... The close-ups just show the rawness of the flesh, like the sunburnt flesh. Like, everybody looks... It doesn't look like, oh, we spent 8 hours in makeup.
Yeah, this like,
no, it does.
Life.
It feels like they're sweating and raw and real. And
it feels dirty. Like, when there's one scene towards the end where Cheyenne splashes water on his face, I felt refreshed as he did that. Because it's like, yes, that's what... I can imagine how much you're clamoring from that water from the well. And it's just like, you know, on his face. And it's just... It's so funny to us in this modern age that we can grab water from a tap or have a wash or I'm just going to get some food. Whereas back then it was all about, you know, conserving and, oh, water from a well.
The well, the fact that he's got that land. Mm. It's like the key component of the film.
The key component,
it's so scarce.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you'll hear a strange sound drop to the ground.
A sound? Like what?
Like that.
The fact that this town is, it didn't feel over designed. In fact, it didn't feel too
big.
Like, you know, quite often in a Western, you pan out, and what they did very well in this, they do this very big kind of like, you know, like over the top shot. As you pan out, I'm expecting to see like this huge Western town, like Back to the Future 3 style. But actually, what you get is this tiny little place that, you know, it's like a village, really.
Well, it's being built, isn't it? It's in the midst of actually being created. But it's really interesting with that shot that it was one of the most complex shots Leone had ever done on any of his films, where it follows her off the train and it's like a rail shot, a tracking shot, and she walks into the station and the camera turns and then like a widescreen shot of her inside the actual station itself, and then it raises up to show the whole town. And he had the whole town specifically built just for this one shot. And the budget to build the town was larger than a fistful of dollars. Like, it cost like $250,000, which was more than it cost for that entire film, just because he wanted that shot to show this town. And like you say, it's not even comparatively that impressive compared to a lot of films we've seen since. And there's like a really classic Western that was sort of done in the 80s with Kris Kristofferson that was like the biggest box office bomb ever. And it was called Heaven's Gate. It's called Heaven's Gate. And there's a shot very similar to this where they basically built this entire Western town, and it's so much more detailed than this, and it must have cost them an absolute fortune. And the entire film was an absolute fortune. But the fact the director had this vision, and the director of photography as well, to do this one shot and spend that much
that's
on it, and they
insane.
Felt it was such a crucial part of this film. And that's the third scene. Like, the second scene, as we mentioned, was the Henry Ford introduction, the iconic shooting of the family, as Etoch said, the shooting of the kid. It's a shocking scene. And even in the American release, there's been a few different releases of this film, like a director's cut, an American release. On the American version, when he goes to shoot them, to shoot the child, it would always cut away before he fired the shot and just go to the train coming in and the horn, sort of being the whistle going on the train, because they were like, we cannot show Henry Fonda on American TV killing a child.
Oh, that's
it's
nuts.
Too much. So
that's crazy.
Those three scenes, honestly, it's, I would say it's, what, 20 minutes of cinema perfection.
Yeah, like, I think
that
you,
good.
You if even you're not necessarily going to watch this whole film, you need to watch that first 20 minutes. But also, I think this film also hinges on, personally, you said Cheyenne, what's his name?
Yeah,
Cheyenne was your favourite character. But I mean, for me, like, Henry Fonda as Frank is pivotal as this kind of, the baddie, the antagonist, you know, there is no sadistic kind of maniac. And his character in this film is crucial because you don't feel anything towards him for most of the film. He doesn't give you anything apart from, you know, ruthlessness and darkness and selfishness. And what Henry Fonda, I've not really seen a lot of his work, but he does it extremely well.
Wait, Frank.
So nobody followed you?
No. You gotta believe me.
So this is the way I can trust you?
I can explain. I know that he...
Get out.
No, Frank.
we talk about Bronson. I think he's incredible in this. Like, I've seen Death Wish. That's it.
The thing. I haven't really seen any of his work.
I don't know loads of his stuff.
Apart from
Dirty Dozen as well. Yeah. And he did a few like westerns around that period. But I think it really ties in again to kind of like the soundtrack and those four main characters having their own sort of score. And Bronson's is, as with his character name, it's just him playing this sort of little tune on the harmonica. And it's amazing.
I think that, weirdly, with the harmonica, like, when he first plays that, I think this was quite a small gripe, but a gripe. When he plays the harmonica, you know he's not playing the harmonica. And I know...
But he can play the harmonica, like, and did it in other films.
So he must have done it afterwards, though, as ADR. It wasn't done on the set. So it didn't feel real enough. And that, you know, compared to how real everything else felt, that felt like, to me, like, oh, he's just like playing it in a voiceover booth.
No, I understand what you're saying, but to me, that's part of what makes it so beautiful, is that it's not like some bloke going,
yeah.
It's part of the soundtrack, so you kind of, and there's an almost like an ethereal sense to it, and his character's full of mystery. I totally get your point, Smith, but I just feel that you know, the soundtrack plays.
I get that.
It's almost like it's like a part of just his presence. It's not. Yeah, and don't get me wrong. I totally understand. I think
it
there's a rawness to it.
Often follows death as well. Often brings death, I should say.
So on the music, like for me, like I wasn't sure what I was going to expect from. But this is not what I expected, because it had so many different kind of feels in it. You know, there's often like classical feel, often like a kind of more drama, cinematic strings, and then crazy kind of guitars. If you kind of watch a Western just generally, like, a music is key to like any film, but especially with a Western. So for this had so many different notes, and like you said, each character having their own soundtrack, but also, you know, at different moments in the film. And what they do so well in this film is at times they know when not to have music.
Yes.
And often, you know, like that opening 2-3 minutes before the Germans start talking. but, you know, like so often we're used to hearing a musical with some acting in film nowadays, and especially big Hollywood films. So although the music peaks in this film, like, this is going way ahead, and we won't go into this quite yet, but, you know, at the final shootout scene. There's nothing. It's perfect.
It's not afraid to take its time, is it? Like you say, it's not afraid of silence either. I was sort of talking about the scene where it rises up and shows the actual town for the first time, and the score was done and it was written beforehand so that when it reaches that top point, the crescendo of like the opera singer happens during that shot, and the song is so loved. Like John Carpenter, for instance, that was the song they played on his wedding day when his kind of wife was walking down the aisle. Loved it that much. This is how much this film kind of influenced a lot of what the things John Carpenter did. And I absolutely love John Carpenter. He's one of my favorite directors of all time, and for someone like that to sort of associate so much with this score is incredible. And I think with Cheyenne's sort of music as well,
I loved his themes in my head forever.
When he first comes on, it's almost like, am I supposed to know this guy from something else? Because that's the way the music makes you feel.
It's like when Peter Griffin has a theme tune in Family
Guy. what I loved about his introduction, Cheyenne's as well, I mean, that scene where he walks into the bar where it's Jill's already there, and as we find out, harmonica's sitting on like that little. He's sitting.
Oh,
on the
bit with the light when he like throws
the
it
light.
To him. Oh.
But one of my favourite parts of that is the reveal. Like, you hear a lot of noise outside, and then he comes in. It's obviously he's been in some sort of gunfight, and then he gets a bottle of booze. This is Cheyenne, and he lifts it up to drink, and then you realise he's in cuffs. Okay, we realise he's a bad guy, or this is like, you know, someone who's on the wrong side of the law. But when he picks up the bottle like that and the camera just kind of trucks in and you see he's got the
yeah, because it's shot above the waist before. You don't see his hands at all.
It's so good. And it's like, oh, man. And that moment, like the we have harmonica and Cheyenne have their first kind of encounter. And it's just, there's so much tension in it, but there's also like... characters are wry smiling at one another. Yeah. It's like, yeah, we know that at some point we're all going to be in a gunfight or something. But
there's this respect between all three of them.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And as we see, you know, toward the end of the film, like at any point, you know, one of them could get shot in the back, but they would never do that because it's like not part of the code type thing. So there is always this respect, especially between Frank and Harmonica, you know, who are...
That scene where Frank leaves the saloon. I love that scene so much. He leaves and Harmonica's upstairs at the window. Yeah,
and he knows.
And he's just... And basically, Frank's men have been sent by Morton like to turn against him.
He's bribed them.
He's been bribed them. And you get that great like shot where Frank's walking around the town and like Harmonica, like, you know, first shoots the gunman out from behind the sign, like bang. And like Frank looks, he's like, oh, okay. And then he's walking around and then there's a bit where he looks and Harmonica says something like, oh, time sure flies. And then he says, just after 12. And he looks up and he sees the gun.
Yeah.
He shoots him as well. But it's great because, and even Jill says to him, why did you save that man? And he's like, was it something like saving a man or something? He says some really awesome quote. That totally
I'm not
forgotten.
Saving him. I'm just not letting them kill him. As if to say, it's not them to do it. It's for me. So, like, going back to Leone as well, and just talking about, like, the influence. Now, like, the way he made his films, they were, like, he took the stock conventions of those, like, American Westerns and kind of reworked them in, a ironic fashion, essentially. That's what he was trying to do. And sort of with a darker connotation. And this film does have those dark elements. And like I said right at the start as well, there's some bits within the film that were directly lifted from other films. And if you'd seen all these Westerns at the time, it's almost like if we watch something where it calls back to another film, like, you'd just be like, oh, that's from this, that's from that. And one of the best ones is from The Searchers, which was a John Ford film from like the 50s, where the bit during that amazing second scene where the family essentially gets slaughtered, there's like all these like crickets and insect sounds that just stop at certain points. And it's when obviously the bad guys are encroaching in. And that was taken directly from The Searchers and that approaching the farmhouse. And then as well, there's
it's almost like, you know, when you walk into a restaurant and everyone stops talking.
and then you just shoot me a few seconds later.
It's like, check, please. but then there was a film like called Johnny Guitar where it's basically about a former prostitute who moves out and like literally is exactly the same. She's like moves into a place that's being turned into a rail house. There's a film called The Iron Horse where it's almost like a shot for shot remake of that first scene of the three people greeting someone at the train station. Yeah, there's a film called Shane where there's a kid and his dad.
I've heard of Shane.
Well, that's another 50s one where a young sort of child's out with his dad hunting, which is again very, very similar to what happens to them. There's a scene called like The Last Sunset from 1961 where the final duel again is shot almost identically, and that's between Kirk Douglas and Rock Hudson, two extraordinarily famous American actors of the time. Again, as I said at the start, this was a spaghetti western. It was filmed in Italy, and Charles Bronson after this film became a huge European film star, which is something we think of these days is quite unheard of, that outside of like the UK and America, like, we don't really think that much of like sort of big kind of films shot certainly in places like Italy. Yes, France may be a bit more of a film culture with Cannes and like Three Colors, Blue, Red and all that type of films of that era, but I would say like European cinema doesn't really have that draw of bringing in American actors, and it did in this era. And that's credit to Leone for like taking those American westerns, a genre that was probably a little bit tired by that point, and giving it a completely different edge.
It was tired, wasn't it? And it felt like Hollywood, or the movie industry I should say, needed something different and raw and real, and that's exactly what this did. So talking about the you said there, you know, like the final kind of standoff, so many westerns are outside the saloon, right? They break out of the saloon. You know, that's kind of what you expect it to be like that. And with this film, you know, it's in this kind of barren desert.
Well, the thing that I like about it is it happens whilst everybody's at work, like going building this
town.
No
one's sitting there watching. Like, there's no audience.
They see each other, or he comes to him, and they literally go, like, well, we'll just go over there then and do this. It's not like it's not made a big deal of in terms of it's just, I found it fascinating. Like you say, the setting, it's just a barren wasteland almost like round the back of the town.
Yeah, it was like almost like by the bins or somewhere. It just felt...
Yeah, every other film is like the traditional outside the saloon. Yeah.
It's midday.
The town stops and gathers. Like
it's all been set up, ready for it. This almost happens... not out of the blue, but you know, it's like it's been building to this moment, but at the same time this moment isn't the most important part of this film, despite it being, you know, like a climax. It needed this climax in that film, but you know, the film does continue after this point. It's not just the end. You know, it does go on from there, and I that was really interesting to me and not what I expected. And to be honest, this whole film was not what I expected, having never really read or seen too much about it.
Well, it is actually the first film of a trilogy. So, like, as we discussed about Once Upon a Time, The Man With No Name, that was a trilogy. This, he did this film, then he did another one called Duck You Sucker, which doesn't really sound like it fits in this genre. It was originally called Once Upon a Time, The Revolution, which is like a Mexican Western. And then the final one is Once Upon a Time in America, which is, of course, like the 1930s gangster film, which has like Robert De Niro in and a bunch of very, very famous actors, and is an incredibly long film.
It's really long.
It's like 4 or 5 hours. It is absolutely huge, and it was sort of seen by many as his masterpiece.
Keep him warm for me. Gives you any trouble, hit him. Not in the mouth, he's got to talk. And plenty.
The cut scene now is 166 minutes, so this is like 2.5 hours. The American cut was 145 minutes, so they chopped off a good 20 minutes. And the original Italian cut was 175 minutes, which is kind of considered the director's cut. And I think the director's cut was what I watched. I think that's the DVD that I've got.
I think mine was 2 hours 55, yeah, the German.
And there's, yeah, mine was...
There is quite an interesting story, actually, where... somewhere in cinema in Paris, they ran this film uninterrupted for 2 whole years. Like, just every single day they would show this film. And when he visited the theater, he was surrounded by all the fans who wanted his autograph. And he went to the projectionist, who basically said to him, "I kill you!" The same movie over and over again for 2 years.
Jesus Christ,
it's so slow. It's just like,
ah. But the thing that really appeals to me about this movie is... And I kind of talked about it in another, I guess, when we did our favourite movies of the 2010s, I think it was, where I said one of my favourite movies of the last 10 years is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. No relation.
Of course.
But in that movie, Tarantino does a lot of what I like to call just filming life, whether it be Brad Pitt in a car driving, or as we see Margot Robbie, I'm using the actors' names, obviously, Margot Robbie and Sharon Tate going to the cinema, and just we see her face or her buying a ticket. And it's just, obviously this film is, I would argue, probably slower in that sense. But that opening scene, again, I can't stress this enough. If some consider this slow-paced and by that, oh, it's dull, I would argue no. If anything, that slow pace is what draws me in and captivates me, makes me go, what's going to happen next? Because when you look at this movie, in terms of action, is it fair to say that there's not a lot of gunfights?
Well, this is the thing, like, the only style is kind of like the build-up, the surrounding, and then the action itself is very quick, whilst sort of other Westerns around the time, say like The Wild Bunch, you'd have these huge drawn-out battles that would last like 20 minutes, like gunfights.
Don't get me wrong, and I love The Wild Bunch, Peckinpah. That shootout at the end is ridiculous,
exactly.
And it's Peckinpah's directional style that carries that movie, but... So very different, like you say. It's just this is all about the build-up. But
there were points for me, like, although, like, I'm totally with you on that, there were points in the film where I was ready for the next scene, and I was like, you know, I sometimes did find that, like, as interesting as the shots were, if the story is not moving along, I felt it could be indulgent. And just because of the setting we are in, and as captivating as it was for most of this film for me, don't get me wrong, but there were points in this film where I was like, okay, let's move the story on slightly here. I did feel like I wanted to move on. And, you know, like, when you said Once Upon a Time in America was what, 5 hours or something, which I remember scene. It does strike me as slightly, personally
indulgent.
why? And I still feel like this film, you know, it maintains that mise-en-scene by doing that. However, there are moments in this film where I think it wouldn't have lost anything by cutting some of those scenes down slightly.
Well, let's not be wrong. Like, when the film was released, it wasn't that well received critically. Mm. It didn't do that well at the box office. It just about broke even in the American box office. It was mainly in Europe that it kind of got this cult following, and then sort of retrospectively, people over the years have kind of identified it as one of, if not the greatest Western ever made.
Is any trivia, first of all, Nige?
Oh, there's tons of trivia on this. So it's going to be like a trivia ensemble. So going to that first scene at the train station, we mentioned the fly. The way they did that, they actually smothered a bit of jam on the actor's face.
Oh, right,
and then they let out a bunch of flies out of a jar and just hoped one would land on his face. But there's actually a really sad story attached to the three gunmen in the jackets. That basically the actor, the one who kind of has the close up and off into the distance, the one who does like the cat noises at the bird, this was actually his last film, because shortly after shooting, well, during the shoot of this film, he actually jumped out of a hotel window and committed suicide whilst wearing the outfit that he wears in the film. The costume designer like rushed out and said, "We've got to get the costume back," which is just really kind of bizarre set of circumstances. Al Murlock was the name of the actor, and as I mentioned previously, he was quite a well-known sort of Western actor at that time, so it's really tragic.
Watching this movie afterwards, it's going to sound weird. Obviously, everything's within context. I felt guilty for having watched Marvel films and thinks, they're fucking brilliant. So I will happily die on a hill and say, one of the best movies I've ever seen.
Wow.
I am giving this a 10 out of 10. Yeah, it's a film that I, like I say, stumbled upon, instantly fell in love with it. And it's, you know, films often make you, you know, they always say, oh, good film should always make you question certain things. One, I question why I'd never seen this before. But it makes you, it questions like some, you know, you look for your Blu-rays or your DVDs and you're like, why? I look at this film and I'm like, this is why filmmaking was invented. That sounds really melodramatic, but I truly believe this is one of the greatest films I've ever seen. I will happily say that. I would recommend this to everybody. I understand why people would have a problem with maybe the speed of it, or sorry, the pace. Maybe some of it's out of date or it's dated. I don't know, storytelling plots or whatever. But I just think it's an incredible movie that I'm so glad I discovered before I died.
Wow. I mean,
and I will happily go back and watch this over and over again. It's a film that I could, I think, have on as almost like a comfort of just like this. It just draws you into that world.
Wow, I'm really pleased you found one of your 10 out of 10s, because it's a rare thing to find, and I'm really pleased that you've got that out of it. I had not seen this film. I was really taken back by the set design, the costumes, the cinematography, the feel of the film, you know, the acting, the writing. You know, I think it is a very good film. But for me, like, I did find moments where I did find it slightly long and overwritten, and some scenes I felt like I was still waiting for the next scene, and I didn't want to feel like that, because I was enjoying visually what I was seeing, but it, you know, like, if the story wasn't necessarily moving along, I was kind of like, oh, and I'm not sure why that was. Maybe the wrong time. You know, you have to watch it at the right time sometimes with a film like this. You have to be in exactly the right mood. I can see why this film gets its classic status, but I'm hesitant to give it a classic score just because it's a classic. And I think a lot of people do that for films like this. And I really enjoyed this film, but for me, it was like a 7.5 out of 10. I mean, it's still a very good score, but, you know, compared to Etox, 10 out of 10, you know, it feels like
slap in the face. this.
You said you have to be in the right place, yeah, or like the right frame of mind, which is, I think, is true of all films. I was eating a big bag of Wotsits.
Ah, that is always the right
like
place.
Like prawn cocktail. Yeah. Have you ever seen those big giant Wotsits?
Giant Wotsits that are fucking amazing. I'll give you that.
So basically, that's what I mean. Buy them and watch Wimbledon and see
Smith,
what happens.
Do it again. We'll do a follow-up review. Have a big packet of Wotsits. And you have to watch it at 1 a.m. yeah, as well. That's when I was doing it. Late night snacks.
Nige, what do you think?
Like, from my perspective, like, the film is long. This podcast is going to be long. So my review is short. 10 out of 10.
Wow.
Wow. Did you? Seriously? Yeah. Oh, Nige. That's amazing.
Like, this is some films I will only watch once every, like, 10 years. And this is one of them because it's so special. It is a 10 out of 10 film.
I didn't think Nige was going to do a 10. He Niged me. He Niged me.
What a twist.
And guys, what do you think? Incredible, 10 out of 10. Let us know. We'd love to know what you think about this one. Get in touch. Email us on offradarpod@gmail.com or tweet us at offradarpodcast. Let us know what you think about this or any of the films we've done so far.